So welcome back, and it's my pleasure to welcome my old friend David Estoper, who's going to be speaking to us about how we get new Bibles for some very old caves. Thank you.
Eddie and Howard and myself, we're all Bible translators in different ways. Howard, I think, has been connected with pretty well every English translation committee there's ever been, haven't you? And Eddie is connected with hundreds of translations, and I'm only connected with one. But I got a letter this week saying that if I want to order the NIV in bulk, I get 50% author's discount. Yeah, so my head got bigger then, and God will strike me down. I'm going to be looking at the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Qumran Bible manuscripts, and looking at one of the problems there, of course, the great variety of Hebrew texts there. And how is it that out of that great variety, we get just one Hebrew manuscript, which we call the Bible? The discovery of the Qumran Bible manuscripts helped confirm the theory that there were many different forms of the Hebrew Bible before the standard one was chosen to be preserved as a Masoretic text. And the first century Jews had many Hebrew Bibles available to them. Subsequent discoveries have reversed that conclusion. It now appears likely that first century Jews had already decided which text form of the Hebrew text was the oldest. And many of the variant readings were conscious paraphrases of that older text. The scholarly consensus is that the Hebrew text of the Old Testament was still fluid in the first century, certainly in the early first century, with many versions in circulation which are often significantly different. And yet, Jesus says in Matthew and in Luke that not one letter or pen stroke will be lost from the text of the Torah. And Josephus claims similarly. He says the books of the whole Old Testament, that during so many ages which have already passed, no one dared to add to them or take from them or make changes. Now, if Hebrew scriptures were still being edited at this time, so that first century readers might never come across two identical texts and had several that they could point to, they would regard these sayings of Jesus and Josephus as absurd claims, which discredit everything else that they were saying. Now, with hindsight, we can apply Jesus' saying about not one letter or pen stroke being missing as applying to the way in which the Hebrew Bible was remarkably transmitted, almost letter perfect by the rabbis for several centuries later, culminating in the amazing work of the Masoretes. But that's only by hindsight. That the rabbis produced our Masoretic manuscripts, the most important of which, of course, are the Aleppo manuscript and the Leningrad manuscript. That's in Leningrad, now called St. Petersburg, and the Aleppo is now in the scrollery in Jerusalem. They comprise not only of the letters, which Jesus and Josephus were talking about, but also the complex system of vowel pointing, which was added to those letters to help us know how to pronounce the words that are in the Hebrew Bible, and also the punctuation, an amazing system of punctuation where 26 different levels of punctuation were used. We use commas and semicolons and colons. They had 18 different ways of subdividing sentences into smaller and smaller groups, so you knew exactly which words would go in one group. And then they also had 8 different systems of conjoining words. Like we have a hyphen to conjoin two words, they had 8 different levels, hierarchies of conjunction. An amazing system of vowels and of punctuation, which the Masoretes added to the text which Jesus had in his hand. And the accuracy with which those vowels transmitted the oral sound of the text can be measured by looking at personal names from Persia, which hadn't been spoken outside scripture for hundreds of years. When you then look at the vowels, which are in the Masoretic text, they do reflect the sounds of those words in the Persian period. So it does look like the sounds had been transmitted accurately. Wonderful, wonderful. And to preserve the actual letters themselves, the consonants which Jesus and Josephus would have had, they had a whole system of the Masorah, that's marginal notes which are on the side of the text, where they noted the central word in every book, the central letter. They counted up how many letters and words went either side. Or if there was a strange spelling of a word, they would note in the margin that this word really is spelt like that, telling the scribe not to correct it, and then telling the scribe the five or six other times in the whole text where he would find the word spelled like that. Hundreds and hundreds of little notes like that in the margin to help the scribe not make one mistake. And this resulted in Hebrew scriptures which were transmitted letter by letter perfect, a feat which no other text has achieved before the printing press. Now, we don't know when those practices started, but we do know they succeeded. We do know they were successful because we have texts from the second century which are letter for letter perfect. If you look at the text of the 12 prophets found at Morabat, you find only 37 tiny details which are different between that text in the 2nd century and the 9th, 10th century Masoretic text. Well, in fact, 37 differences between Leningrad and the text of the 12 prophets from the 2nd century. And those differences are mostly variations in spelling, slight changes in spelling. And and there's 11 corrections in that text towards the standard text. It's amazing. Immanuel Tov summarizes it as, the only differences with the medieval text pertain to orthography, that's the spelling and putting in vowel marks, a few minute details, paragraphing, and the layout of individual psalms. And those variations resemble the internal differences between the medieval manuscripts of the MT themselves. Now, that tidy situation in the 2nd century is very different from what was so in the 1st century. In the 1st century, we have a huge variety of different Hebrew manuscripts, as illustrated by the Dead Sea Scrolls themselves. So, if everything was still so fluid in the 1st century, how did authors like Matthew and Luke and Josephus make such absurd claims that the text was fixed? How did they get away with that when the people reading them knew that the text wasn't fixed? The answer, which this paper will argue for, is the solution lies in the great standardization project, which was as important to Jews in the early first century as the genome project is important today. First of all, let me tell you what was found at Qumran. It was the Dead Sea Scrolls discovered near Qumran, a monumental addition to our knowledge of the first century world. They're immediately datable because the community was wiped out by the Romans in 68 AD, so we know everything came from before that. The paleography is established that the collection held manuscripts which went back to about 250 BC, so we have a collection of manuscripts which finish about 70 AD and go back about 250 BC. The types of biblical texts at Qumran had in many ways been predicted by scholars, but they'd inferred many from the differences between the Masoretic texts and the Septuagint, that's the Greek translation, and the Targums, that's the Aramaic translations, and the Samaritan Pentateuch, which is slightly different. They'd inferred that there must be Hebrew texts behind those manuscripts, because the changes or the variants could have been due to inaccurate and inventive scribes, but it's unlikely because often those texts agreed with each other. So the Samaritan Pentateuch would agree with the Septuagint, and presumably there's a Hebrew original behind that. So they assumed that there was a variety of Hebrew texts available before the time of Jesus. And sure enough, the texts at Qumran showed that. Discoveries at Qumran helped confirm this, but they also added new layers of complexity to the picture. Some of the Bible manuscripts appeared to have features similar to the Greek Septuagint, suggesting they were similar to the Hebrew text before that. Some had features similar to the Samaritan Pentateuch, and many manuscripts shed light on the Aramaic readings in the Targum, though, of course, many more manuscripts were similar to the Masoretic text. Now, all that had been predicted, and that was no surprise, but what the surprise was that half of the texts found at Qumran were like nothing that had ever been seen before. They weren't the Masoretic text, they weren't Samaritan, they weren't Septuagint, they were something else completely different, and they were different from each other. Now, among those 25,000 fragments. 25,000 fragments were found at Qumran. They've now been stuck together with sellotape. Well, at first they were stuck together with sellotape. It was very embarrassing. They're now put together a bit more carefully and found 900 manuscripts. Among those, about 200 are recognisable as Bible texts, Bible manuscripts or fragments of Bible texts, ranging from the huge Great Isaiah scroll, the only complete scroll found at Qumran, to very small fragments which have just a few letters in them and can just about be recognised as part of the Bible. Now, these represent just a small fraction of what was originally there, because, for instance, in Cave 8, where you've got fragments from four manuscripts, there are the leather binding tags which have survived from many other manuscripts, and they reckon there were 68 full scrolls in that cave, but only fragments of four have survived. So the whole library must have been huge. So the fact that no fragments exist from a couple of the smaller Bible books, Esther and Nehemiah, shouldn't be regarded as significant. We only have a small fragment from the whole of Chronicles. So the fact that Nehemiah isn't there doesn't mean they didn't use Nehemiah. Now, the easiest way to evaluate this material is to use the so-called Dead Sea Scrolls Bible, which you can buy in any ordinary bookshop. It's a wonderfully accessible translation of the Judean Bible texts. I used to look at this with scorn, thinking it's too easy to use, but it does have the information about all the texts that are actually being mentioned. The footnotes indicate which manuscripts any difference is found in. And wherever any text in the Qumran differs from the Masoretic text, the translation is in italics. So it's very easy to spot and see what the differences are. But that does tend to exaggerate the number of variants which are found, because they'll always use a text which is different from the Masoretic text. So, for example, at Genesis 1:15, it translates, "They were for signs and for seasons," whereas the Masoretic text reads, "Let them be signs and for seasons." But the footnote points out that only one of the three manuscripts found at Qumran actually has this difference. The other two are exactly the same as the Masoretic text. So it does tend to exaggerate the number of differences. And the footnotes also usefully tell you whether it agrees with the Samaritan Pentateuch and whether it agrees with the Greek Septuagint. Now, of the fragments which have been recovered, only 121 are large enough to analyse their text type and decide whether they are like the standard text or... Sorry, I keep using the word standard text. What I mean here is we can't call these texts which agree with the Masoretic text, we can't call them Masoretic text, because the Masoretic text has all those vowel pointings on. It's the same consonants as the Masoretic text, but there's no vowel pointings, there's no punctuation, there's no stylized system. So we call it a standard text. The standard text existed in the first century. Now, of those 121 where you can analyse what sort of text it is, Emmanuel Tov has found that there are four which are similar to the Septuagint, there are three which are similar to the Samaritan Pentateuch, and there are 57 which conform more or less to the standard text. I say more or less, there's quite a lot of differences in those with the standard text than the second century ones, but we'll get into the reason for those differences. Another 57 are the variety. That's easy to remember, isn't it, for people who eat Heinz. 57 of these don't fit into any conformity at all. And the larger fragments demonstrate the uncertainty of assigning text to any one group, because they often have some features of Samaritan, some features of Septuagint, and most features of standard text. And you find even more variant readings when you look at the commentaries which are at Qumran. You go through the commentaries and they're quoting texts which are not our standard texts, they're not as in our Hebrew Bibles, and they're basing their interpretations on them. So they regarded those variants as inspired, I guess. Now, all that helped confirm that the Hebrew text of the Old Testament was still very fluid during the first century. But subsequent discoveries after Qumran threw doubt on that conclusion. Because when you look at the Qumran publications, it's not called Texts from Qumran, it's called Discoveries in the Judean Desert. We didn't find texts just at Qumran. Texts are also found at Masada, at Wadi Sadir, at Nahal Heva, at Nahal Salim, and Murabat. They weren't the wonderful, huge collections you found at Qumran, but they're significant. Although most people just ignore them because the Bible manuscripts which are found at these sites were all conforming to the standard text. They didn't have any interesting variants, or very, very few. Well, they had very few variants and they weren't interesting, so they were largely ignored. But this gives us a situation which is entirely different, because now we have to say to ourselves, every site in Palestine where ancient Bibles have been found contain manuscripts which are standard texts, except at Qumran. All the Bibles found in Palestine from the 1st and 2nd century are standard texts. In other words, they're pretty well what the Masoretes had. In some cases, exactly what the Masoretes had, except those at Qumran. So all other Jews were rejecting non-standard texts, and Qumran seems to be collecting them. Now that throws new light on the collection that you actually find at Qumran, because then it suggests that the half of the texts at Qumran, which are standard texts, they are the main collection, and the other half, which are different, are the odd ones out, and they are already being regarded as inferior. Our view of the variety of texts at Qumran was disproportionately influenced by the Great Isaiah Scroll. It was the first one which was studied in detail because it's so large, the only complete scroll found at Qumran, and it clearly diverged from the standard text. However, in retrospect, we could regard the standard text as a de facto majority text at Qumran. The non-standard texts form a very disparate group, and only a few of those can be categorized into other families. There's 4% close to the Septuagint, about 6% close to the Samaritan text, which means the standard text, the family of texts called the standard text, is 10 times more present than the next closest group of texts. Now, different scholars have constructed different histories to account for this. Some older scholars theorize that all the standard texts reflected a single ancient text from which the Samaritan Pentateuch and Hebrew behind the Greek Septuagint had diverged at some point, and which the Jews had rightly rejected by the time of the temple being destroyed in 70 CE. Or more recently, the standard text has been regarded as one text among many which somehow came to prominence. Some saw this process starting in the 2nd century BC when the Maccabean Wars destroyed most of the manuscripts and just a few were left, and caused a greater interest in finding a single text form. But other scholars think that this happened later at 70 AD when Judaism was almost completely destroyed by the Romans, and perhaps this was the only text that was left, and so by an accident of history, this is the one which we have. By whatever means the history of those texts is explained, all scholars recognize that during the first century a wide variety of texts were available, and variant readings were widely known. People knew the differences between the texts and the translations, and maybe these readings were popularized through those translations, maybe through preaching, and we can see those variants being used by Jesus in the Gospels. Let me show you a couple of examples from the Gospels. Now, Josephus believed in an unchanging Bible text, and yet he often uses readings from the Septuagint and from the Targums when he's retelling the Bible story. So although he believes in a single Bible text, he's often using the slight changes in translations for his own retelling. And Jesus does the same thing in Matthew 15:9, for instance. He says to the Pharisees, says about the Pharisees, they revere me in vain, or they worship me in vain, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. And he's quoting from Isaiah 29:13. But when you look at the Masoretic text, it's a rather different. Their reverence for me is a commandment taught by men. And it's only when you look in the Septuagint you find something similar to what Jesus is saying. They revere me in vain, teaching the commandments and doctrines of men. The Septuagint wasn't used simply because the Gospel is being written in Greek and that's the first thing that Matthew had to hand. But because Jesus saying actually depends on that translation. It actually depends on that reading. He's saying that the teaching of the Pharisees consisted of merely human commands. And that text forms the basis of his complaint, but only in the version represented by the Septuagint. Because in the Masoretic text, it implies that they are recipients of such teachings, while the Targums merely compares their worship to such teaching. It's only the Septuagint which actually says what Jesus wants to say. And similarly, in Mark 4:12, we have an example of Jesus using a reading which is found in later Targum of Isaiah 6, where it ends, "They may be forgiven. They may turn, and their sins may be forgiven them," in Mark 4:12. And in the Masoretic text, it says that they may turn, and I will heal them. Now, Matthew, in this case, actually changes the quotation to conform to the standard text, to conform to the Masoretic text. But Mark is quite happy to have this, have Jesus say that they may be forgiven, even though it's not in the Hebrew, it's not in the Septuagint either. The Septuagint reads that they may turn and I will heal them. And it's only in the Targums you have they may turn and be forgiven. So Jesus is quoting the text in a form which is being transmitted in Aramaic in the Targums, not in the Hebrew Bible. So what language did Jesus actually quote the Bible in? When he's quoting the Bible to people, what's he speaking in? Well, we know one quotation from the Old Testament, which he's speaking in a language of his own choice, when he's on the cross. And he says, "Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani," in Aramaic. It's clearly Aramaic. And yet he's not quoting from what we know of as the Targum, the Aramaic Targum, the traditional Aramaic form. Because there it says, "Metul ma sabachthani." And he's actually conforming the Aramaic language to the vocabulary of the Hebrew. He's quoting the standard text and yet translating it into Aramaic. People of the time didn't understand Hebrew very much. It was the language of scholars. Even legal documents were written in Aramaic. That's the language of the people. So Jesus, when he was preaching, would have been preaching in Aramaic. And here we have him speaking to himself or speaking to God, and presumably not using the cross as a pulpit, speaking in Aramaic and translating the Hebrew Bible into Aramaic for his own use. And presumably, when he's speaking to the common people, he would also be doing that. So here he is using Aramaic, but using the standard text, unless the standard text doesn't fit the emphasis he wants to give, and then he's quite happy to use a variant from the Septuagint or from the Targum. But in the first century, we have a wide variety of texts, and yet there's a recognition that there's one text which is special. There's one text which everyone is aiming towards. And that's the standardization project which was going on in the first century. Let me give you some evidence from rabbinic traditions about this standardization project and what they were doing. Now, rabbinic stories, which is where I spend most of my academic life, are very unreliable. I like to stick to rabbinic legislation, because when lawyers get their fingers into something, it's accurate. You may hate it, but they're accurate. And they quibble about little differences, and they'll say, no, this word isn't quite right, and they'll get paid a lot. And we hate them, but they keep the text accurate. When it comes to stories, it's not like that. If a preacher says, Martin Luther said, "I had a dream," you don't stand up and correct him and say, no, that was Martin Luther King. You just let it go. And with the stories in rabbinic literature, a lot of errors creep in because no one bothers to correct them. There aren't any lawyers around to correct them. So we have to be careful with these stories. But here is a story which has often rightly been dismissed as suspicious. But I think there is good reason for believing that this has a basis in history. Let me read you the tradition and you can think about it. Three scrolls were found in the temple courtyard: the Ma'on scroll, the Zatzuri scroll, and the He scroll. In one scroll they found written at Deuteronomy 33:27, a habitation, that's the masculine Ma'on, is the eternal God. But in two scrolls it was written, a habitation, using the feminine Ma'ona, is the eternal God. And they confirmed the two and abrogated the one. Right, so what they've got is three scrolls lined up in the temple court, and in one scroll it's got a habitation in the masculine form, and in two of them it's got slight variation. It's got a he at the end, making it into the feminine form. So they say, well, which one shall we take as being authoritative? Well, two is better than one, so we'll take the reading which is in the two. Then there's also a text that's Exodus 24:1. He sent the young men, the Zatuti of the sons of Israel, da, 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 da. And in two scrolls it was written, he sent the young men, the Na'ari, of the sons of Israel. So they're using two different words for young men, Zatut and Na'ar. And they confirmed the two and abrogated the one. So again, two scrolls had the word Na'ar, one had an Aramaic word, Zatut, and they decided the two were better than the one. And then this other scroll, in one scroll they found written she, but spelled like he, corrected 11 times. And in another scroll, in two scrolls they found they corrected 11 times. In one scroll it was only corrected 9 times. Now it was an archaic form, that the words pronounced exactly the same way. It's just a yod instead of a vav. It makes very little difference, but this was a little anomaly, and in 11 occasions, the scribe had updated the scroll, and in this other scroll here, the scribe had updated it only 9 times. And they decided which was correct. Well, two scrolls are better than one, so we'll do it. We'll go along with the two. So in every case, they tried to correct it, but they didn't say to themselves, well, you know, there shouldn't be an Aramaic word in the Hebrew scroll there. We'd better get rid of that and go with the Hebrew word. They just said, well, two scrolls is better than one. And in every case, they seem to have made probably the right decision. But they didn't think about it. They just went by numbers of scrolls. Now, that rabbinic tradition is very difficult to date. You often get clues about how to date things by who said it or who's involved in something or the things which are around it and the chronological development of this passage. And none of that helps in this case. And I go through some details here about how none of it helps. Yeah, so I won't bother with that. It comes to a dead end, but the scholars want to know. But what you have to ask yourself sometimes with these stories is, would they invent it? Now, just after this tradition, you have a tradition about various genealogies which were found in the temple, where it says that various rabbis came from very famous ancestors, or came from ancestors that we know about who had similar sounding names. So you says that Hillel, who was a very famous rabbi, descended from David, who was a very famous person. And it says, Rabbi Yannai came from Eli, which sort of sounds the same. And Ben Kalba came from Caleb, which sort of sounds the same. And Rabbi Nehemiah, who did he descend from? Well, Nehemiah. That, we say to ourselves, would that be invented? We say, yes, come on. That's just a nice story for the children to remind them who's who. And then we come to the tradition of the three scrolls. We ask ourselves, would it be invented? And the answer has to be no, because it implies something quite embarrassing about the state of the biblical text in the time of the Second Temple. It implies that at the time of the temple, there was no single manuscript which was correct throughout. And the only way in which they could produce a correct manuscript is by having three which were almost all right, and then try and construct from there what a perfect one would have looked like. Now, an invented account would have said something like, in the temple courtyard were 20 scrolls which are all exactly identical. Or they'd say something more fanciful like, in the days of the temple, no scribe ever made any mistake. That's the sort of story you'd invent. And the rabbis were quite capable of writing and believing such stories. You probably heard the story of Aristeas tells about how the Septuagint started, how King Ptolemy called in 70 scribes and they all translated the Old Testament into Greek and every single one was word-perfect identical. Well, the rabbis make it even more extraordinary that their version is King Ptolemy brought together 72 elders, placed them in 72 separate rooms without telling them why they'd been brought together, and then went into each one of them and said to him, "Translate for me the Torah of Moses, your master." And then God prompted each one of them, and they all conceived the same idea, and they wrote for him, and then it gives a long list of changes, which are different from the Masoretic text, which are in the Septuagint, changes which the rabbis felt were very helpful. Such as, for instance, that change that we had in one of those scrolls there, using that Aramaic word zatut for young men, because the na'ar could mean a slave, you know, that God called the slaves up, and they didn't want that possibility to be there, so they changed the word, and then in the Greek it was translated so that it wouldn't be a slave. So that they have fanciful stories which they're quite willing to believe, but this story does sound believable because it is not fanciful. They had no one text which was perfect. And also it is possible to date this text, paradoxically, by a text which misunderstands it. That the story of the three scrolls helps to explain various references later to correcting scrolls. There's the text which says, when you teach your son, teach him from a corrected scroll. A scroll that is not corrected can only be kept for 30 days. The king, when he writes his scroll, he takes it to the courtyard and they correct it by comparing it to the scroll of the temple courtyard. Oh, by the way, that's how we think it happened. The point of having these three texts in the temple is that everyone has their own synagogue text, which they bring along to the temple and they compare with those three, and then they correct their scrolls according to what is there in the temple. So that's how they're managing to standardize their texts. And we have texts where we can see those corrections have been happening, correcting towards that standard text. So we have a few references in later rabbinic traditions about this story, but the one which helps us to understand that this was early is a misunderstanding. Because you have a rule in Mishnah which says that on a festival day, they do not correct even a single letter in the scroll of the temple court. Now, that tradition clearly knows that there are scribes working in the temple court. It knows that there are scrolls in the temple court, and it thinks that those scribes are correcting the scroll in the temple court. In other words, they've forgotten what those scrolls were there for. They're there so that people can come and correct their own scrolls, or they can hire scribes to correct their own scrolls by comparing it with the scroll in the temple court. This is the tradition from the early 2nd century, so around about 120. By that time, they've already misunderstood that older tradition about the three scrolls. So we say to ourselves, if they've misunderstood it, it must be at least a generation, probably two generations back when that tradition started. So that puts it back. I do this sort of thing all day. It sounds like convoluted mishmash to you, but sometimes it's the only way in which you can date these rabbinic traditions, because they didn't leave dates on them. And you have to be a bit conniving, and I compare myself to Hercule Poirot. Except I can't get the witnesses in the lounge anymore. They're dead. Of course, that also means they can't answer back. So there is some evidence there that the tradition about the three scrolls in the temple was based on real history. When you've seen that, and then you look back at the Qumran texts, you start to see what's going on there. Because you can see in those texts at Qumran the same sort of corrections you would expect to find from that story. We can see examples of that standardization process taking place on those texts. Now Tov, that's Emmanuel Tov in Jerusalem, he's already pointed out that the texts which were assigned in the family of standard texts, which he found were closest to standard texts, they have been corrected to align more accurately with the standard text. And he's shown many examples of this. And that suggests that these texts have been copied from an exemplar which was close to the standard text, and then they took it along to the temple or to somewhere else where they had something, an even better standard text, which they didn't have for long-term copying, and corrected it. And sometimes it's corrected in the same hand as the scribe who wrote it, so it's not someone else coming along later. It's a two-stage process in copying a standard text. So we can see that happening at Qumran. We also see it in the later copies outside Qumran and the ones at Masada, which are more or less the same time as Qumran, corrections in the text towards the standard text. So that copy of the 12 prophets, a huge scroll, which is almost complete 12 prophets, which is almost exactly Leningrad Codex, almost exactly the same as 9 centuries later, it has 11 corrections, and each of those corrections push it towards the Leningrad Codex, as if someone in a time machine had come and made a copy. It is amazing. However, those corrections did not only occur in manuscripts which were originally copied from standard texts. We also find evidence for correcting towards a standard text, even in manuscripts which were copied in that disparate group, the 57 varieties, if you like. The later scribes took those texts and corrected them towards the standard text. A good place to look for examples is Deuteronomy, because there we got several manuscripts of Deuteronomy, and now and then the fragments overlap. So I looked for a place where you got 2 or 3 fragments overlapping, so we can see what's happening. Deuteronomy is also a good place because you've got the Samaritan Pentateuch to look at, and of course you've got the Septuagint. So I looked in Deuteronomy 11. I didn't have much time for this, I'm afraid. You know, I left the preparation of this paper too late, and so I didn't have time to do a big study in this area. And I just looked in one chapter. I'm sorry. Well, actually, I only looked in a couple of verses, because after a couple of verses, I had 3 examples and I stopped. So this is not a wide survey, but I point this out to say, actually, it's not hard to find. In Deuteronomy 11, I looked in verse 8 to 10. The Masoretic text says, "Go in and possess the land which you, plural, are crossing over to possess." And in verse 10, "For the land which you, singular, are about to go in and possess is not like the land of Egypt from where you, plural, came from, where you sowed your singular seed and watered it with your singular foot like a garden of herbs." I'm sorry about this plural and singular. It's necessary to see there's a bit of confusion there. At the start of verse 10, it's talking about you lot going off into Egypt. And the second half of verse 10 is talking about in Egypt, where you might have had a piece of land as small as a little herb garden, but you wouldn't have had anything bigger than that. You're going off to the promised land where you'll have a whole farm. You know, it's going to be a great place. And the Masoretic text has got confused between the singular and plural, because it says, "For the land which you, singular, are going into is not like the land of Egypt where you, plural, came from." It should have been plural in the first one. So at Qumran, we find changes which help the reader. That plural has been corrected. It's been corrected to a plural. Also, where it says "go in and possess the land that you are crossing over to possess," it sounds a bit strange. What you want an object, really, for this crossing over. So in one of the Qumran texts, it says, "Go in and possess the land which you are crossing over the Jordan to possess." Makes much more sense. And also it says, yes, I like this, in Egypt you had a piece of land which you could water with your foot. What they're talking about is irrigation canals. Instead of having to dig an irrigation canal, you just scratch a groove with your foot and you've irrigated enough for your little bit of land which you can grow a few herbs on. But the problem is, irrigating with your foot sounds a bit rude in Hebrew. You have to realize that urine is foot water. And so, So irrigating with your foot gives the wrong sort of picture and you get sniggering in the back of the synagogue. So what they did was they changed it to irrigating it with your feet. So that clearly is sort of digging something just with your feet. And that makes it okay. So they made these changes in the manuscripts that we find at Qumran to make things easier, to make the text easier, and to make it so that it can be read out in the synagogue nicely and be understandable. But in a couple of those manuscripts, they've been corrected back again. That plural, which looks right now, has been scratched out, and a singular "you" has been put in, which doesn't make any sense at all, except that's what's in the standard text in Jerusalem. And the "feet" has been crossed out, and "foot" has been written in again. Not because the person wants to get a rude snigger, but because that's what's written in the scroll in Jerusalem. Oh, by the way, the crossing over the Jordan, even before we found the manuscript at Qumran, which has that edition, the NIV added it in because it just felt it wasn't reading very smoothly, so it put it in to make the English work more smoothly, and clearly some Hebrew scribe thought exactly the same way 2,000 years before that. But these changes were made to make the text more easy to read and to clear up obvious errors, and yet someone came along later and corrected them, wrongly, it seems, put the mistakes back in, because that was the standard text. And that's the project which was going on throughout Palestine in the first century. Everyone was correcting their manuscripts towards the standard text. So by the time we get to the second century, everything is clean and correct. They're all centered in on that one standard text, which has been transmitted to us carefully. Now, where do those variant readings come from? Did they come from a big variety of manuscripts beforehand? Well, the vast majority of those variants consist of different styles of spelling or grammar, and really they're uninteresting. But the interesting variants are those which result in a different meaning, or they explain an obscure reading. It's generally recognized that the standard text is the most difficult one. It has the largest number of obscure or problematic readings. And the variant manuscripts tend to contain explanations or easier versions of that sometimes obscure or corrupt Hebrew. And it's a happy coincidence that the modern scholars generally agree the standard text was probably the correct one for the rabbis to choose, because it contained all the archaic Hebrew. It contained the uncorrected corruptions. The other versions often offer solutions for those difficult readings, and those solutions may well be correct, but they are corrections to the older, more difficult text. Now, that suggests that one source of the variance was actually the scribes themselves. The scribes who were doing the copying sometimes wished to help the reader, and that theory is found support in a study aiming to show something completely different. Emmanuel Tove, who was looking to try and identify which of the manuscripts at Qumran were written by the scribes at Qumran themselves, looked at all the scribal practices in all the manuscripts. And he found something interesting. He found that there's a group of manuscripts which he calls the deluxe manuscripts. They were written on the highest quality vellum. They were written with large margins, written with lines, and slowly written in careful, clear Hebrew. The deluxe versions, which are more expensive to produce. And then the others, which he assumes were written for individuals. He thinks the deluxe ones were written for synagogues or for communities, teachers, to use carefully. The others are written for individuals, and it's the ones which are written for individuals which have these variants. They have the helpful Hebrew. They have the easier Hebrew. And it's almost as if the scribe is saying, this person is never going to understand what that Hebrew means. I'll put it in more modern Hebrew. And they put in a variant. That doesn't mean that the scribes were inventing these variants. They didn't need to. And when we've actually looked for any variants which might help Qumran theology, you find none at all. It doesn't look like the scribes have invented any variants, but they didn't need to, because when people have translated into Greek or translated into Aramaic, the traditional Aramaic way in which they spoke in the synagogue, that they would have had to invent something. You come across some obscure Hebrew, when you translate it, you've got to come to a decision as to what it means. And so you translate it in some way or another, which means you've got to construe what that Hebrew was originally. And the scribes just copied that easier Hebrew into the text when they made a copy. Now, there's got to be a lot more work in that. There are going to be many places where those variants come from older manuscripts, but a lot of the variants which are easier Hebrew are certainly explainable that way, but it needs more work. So in conclusion, the differences between the Bibles found at Qumran and the rest of Palestine are stark, and the explanation isn't clear. Perhaps the separatists at Qumran simply did not recognize the primacy of the standard text. Perhaps they reveled in variant readings and interpretations based on those readings. Perhaps the Qumran community were avid collectors and they loved variety and quirky examples of manuscripts, like modern-day stamp collectors who want to have a standard copy of everything, but they also love collecting misprints and rare varieties. Or perhaps the Qumran Jews were just as keen on establishing a standard text as everyone else, but their isolation meant that they didn't have access to the best exemplars. And the truth is probably a combination of all of those. However, the standard text was undoubtedly important at Qumran. There were 10 times as many fragments from the standard text as from any of the closest text family. And all the types of text show corrections towards the standard text, as not as systematically or as accurately as outside Qumran, but in the same sort of way. And the fact that the scrolls made for individuals tended to contain more variants may suggest that some were deliberate emendations to help the reader. Jesus and Josephus were just as willing to use those variants, though they didn't introduce them into the Hebrew text. Josephus was writing in Greek, Jesus was teaching in Aramaic. They were willing to follow the easier readings in the Hebrew, but they both expressed confidence in one Hebrew text, which Josephus said hadn't changed and Jesus said wouldn't change. Jesus affirmed that this text would remain the same forever, and the identity between the standard text and the Masoretic text is certainly remarkable. Now, this paper's gathered evidence that the standardization project was being carried out in the early first century. So although the process wasn't complete, the statements of Jesus and Josephus about the exact continuity of the Hebrew scriptures wouldn't have been regarded as absurd by the first readers, and they would have known which text Jesus was referring to. Thank you. Before the questions, can I pass around some things about Tyndale House? If you don't know about Tyndale House, this will tell you. And also, I often do more popular writing, which I publish on the internet. And if you give me your email address, you'll hear of those things and also hear about Tyndale House.
Questions? Yes?
That's a really nice talk. Thank you very much. There's one thing I didn't understand, though. You said
only one. Good.
You said that Jesus said the standard text would not change. But then you said he quoted from the Septuagint when he wanted to. And I don't see how these two things square in each other.
Yes. To say that he's quoting from the Septuagint, of course, is a bit wrong in that he would be speaking Aramaic, so he's not speaking the Greek of the Septuagint. At least we assume he's preaching in Aramaic. We every time we hear his actual words, they're in Aramaic. So what he's saying really is, well, that translation by the Septuagint scribes, that's what the meaning of the Hebrew is that I want to express now. And we do the same sorts of things when we're preaching. We say, well, you know, the RSV comes closer to what I want to emphasize here, and so I'll use that this Sunday. Or the NIV expresses it better for what I want to emphasize. And you pick the translation which emphasizes the aspect of the underlying text that you want to get across. So you're not fooling anyone. Everyone knows what the Hebrew text is, but they then see where you're getting at, what you're getting at, and what your message is.
Thank you very much. I wanted to ask about a couple of instances. First of all, there's a psalm where it says in the Masoretic text, my ear has now opened in the sense of deeds. And in the Septuagint and New Testament, it becomes paraphrased to a body has now prepared me. Now, is that phrase, a body you have prepared me, to be found in the Hebrew version, or is it actually an inspired paraphrase in the Greek from the original?
Yeah, I can see Howard bursting to answer that for me. I'm afraid I'd need warning to look into the details, and I don't have them at my fingertips. I'm very sorry.
Yeah, the other one was in Paul's quote from in Romans, where it says the word of faith, and in the Old Testament, it says neither is it beyond the sea. And Paul understands beyond to mean under the sea and says in the deep. Does this have a cause?
I did a PhD on the use of the Old Testament in the New a couple of decades ago, and didn't deal with those examples anyway. And I declare my ignorance.
Thank you very much. For those of us who don't spend our days poring over rabbinic text, I just want.
What do you do?
Health and safety and budgets. I wonder whether you could just sort of give us some insight into actually what it is you do. You may find that. I'll get more specific. You mentioned that the texts are corrected, and I was wondering, you know, how do we know this? Can we see the tippets?
Oh, yeah, yes.
And then just the other one, you mentioned comparing two texts from Leviticus, was it? Do you get two manuscripts? Do you have those on a screen?
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
You can see the Dead Sea Scrolls. They are. You can't see them on the web. That's one of the scandals of the scrollery. They've now got a huge amount of money to re-photograph all the scrolls, and I think it tied in with that was a legal obligation. They had to put them on the web, so they're starting to turn up there now. And the Great Isaiah Scroll is there in wonderful detail, but most of the texts aren't. But you've always been able to see them on the microfiche publications, and of course you have to come to Tyndale House to do that. And the microfiche ones are actually better than the computer ones. The photographs are fantastic. One scholar who was working at Tyndale House, he came to me just before coffee. He said, David, I found two letters. He found two extra letters which weren't in the printed edition, because when you enlarge the microfiche enough, you can see these, right near the edge of where the manuscript is fraying, you can sometimes pick out letters. It's a very exciting place to work. But actually what I did for this was use that wonderful translation of the Bible manuscripts by Abegg. As I said, I was in a hurry. And it's great, because the italics tell you, hey, go and have a look at the Hebrew. And you can quickly look up what the text is in the Qumran text. I would say I have a copy in my pocket, but in order not to bulge my pocket, I put my palm in the bag there. I've got a copy of the Dead Sea Scrolls in the palm. And anyone has a copy, you can. And when you look at the photographs, yes, things are crossed out with the correction, either put in the margin or put supralinearly above. The corrections are there.
Does what you're saying have any significance for the extent of the canon at that period?
No. It's very difficult to. I see where you're getting at. You mean, do the non-canonical books, as we call them non-canonical, do they have the same corrections? I would imagine they would not, because they don't have a standard text to compare to. But it would be really a good idea to look. I mean, obviously there are a lot more corrections than the corrections towards a standard text, because scribes make mistakes, and those mistakes, so just the scribal errors, are being corrected. So you'd have to look to see what is being corrected. But the trouble is, with the non-canonical books, we don't have the manuscripts to compare to. We don't have Samaritan Pentateuch version of Baruch or whatever. And it would be difficult to do that. But of course, all the books of the Old Testament as we know them are represented at Qumran, except for Nehemiah and Esther. And I think that's just accidental. They're just too small. But also there are other books, Enoch and whatever, and we just don't know whether they regarded them as inspired. Like you said, Jude quotes from Enoch. Is that because he regards this as part of his canon or not? And I don't know any way to work it out. And we have this mysterious list of 22 books from Josephus, which people can put together as 22 books in the Old Testament. You know, Kings is one book, Chronicles is one book. You can do this sort of thing and get 22. But you can never be quite sure that you've done the maths correctly. And maybe the one slips in. I don't know how to give a definitive answer from the Qumran discoveries as to what the canon would be. But do you have any suggestions? Yeah, but looking for those corrections is a nice idea. that it might suggest there aren't any corrections towards the standard text because they weren't in the standard text. Yeah.
Ask a rather scandalous pseudo-historic question. Most people seem to feel that the people who went to Qumran were exiled and were driven away by very adverse circumstances of one kind or another. Is it possible that in actual fact they were expelled because they kept offering things and weren't?
I just repeat the question because some of you might not have heard it. Yeah, it's normally argued that the Qumran community had sort of exiled themselves from the temple. But were they actually expelled from the temple because they were having non-orthodox scriptures and stuff? Is that what you're... Yeah.
Oh, what a wonderful idea. Unfortunately, I don't think that can be so. We know pretty well why they didn't have anything to do with the temple, because they didn't want any festivals to happen on the Sabbath. And they had a different calendar, a very, very specialised calendar, and perhaps they had one which was older than the one being used in the temple, and perhaps they were right, but who cares? They cut themselves off from everyone else and went and lived in the desert. But most of the manuscripts there at Qumran were not written by them. They were collected. And one of the things that Tov was trying to find out was which manuscripts were written by the scribes at Qumran and which ones had been collected. We're not sure exactly which fit into which groups, but it's pretty certain that this was a collection of manuscripts. And the ones which are collected from outside Qumran have more corrections than the ones which are more identifiably Qumran. So, we can't say that those variants were only at Qumran. They were being collected. But they weren't being expunged at Qumran as quickly as everywhere else.
You said that they dated from about 70 AD back to 200 BC. Can they date them at all?
It's difficult. Yeah, it's very difficult dating these manuscripts, and I think really it's witchcraft. I think that's how they do it. Yeah, I don't think it's a science at all. No, but somehow they seem to come to. They look at the shapes of letters and the way in which they're written. But I don't really understand because you also have this archaic script, which some of the we have a half dozen scrolls in archaic script, the Paleo Hebrew. But they're later. They're from the first century, and someone is deliberately writing in this archaic script. And how can it? I don't know how they do it. No. It's not based on sort of carbon dating of the vellum because they're just too close to each other a long time ago. You know, there's just a couple of percentage points between. So no, you can't do it that way. So I have to declare ignorance there too.
The places like Masada, that can't be later than 70 AD.
Oh, sure, yeah. We can always say it can't be later than, because Qumran was destroyed in 68 and Masada was 72. But it's how far back they go.
Going back to the previous answer, you say some the manuscripts were collected from outside and others written there. How would you tell the difference?
Well, that's one of the things that Tov was looking at, the sort of scribal practices and the sorts of things they did at Qumran. Can you collect a group of manuscripts? And they looked at the scribal practices in the Bible manuscripts and then in the sectarian ones, the ones which only the people at Qumran would have had, the Manual of Discipline and the Community Scroll. Things like the Book of Enoch would have been used outside Qumran anyway, so you can't be sure. So he looked at those manuscripts which they knew were Qumran, written by Qumran scribes, and then tried to find that sort of scribe writing somewhere else. And some of those identities were quite successful. The corrector of the Great Isaiah scroll has been identified as a scribe who wrote out part of, I think it was Manual of Discipline. That's really tedious and careful work. But that's the sort of thing you can do. You can identify someone's handwriting. But working out what time that handwriting came from, that's the real art.
Shall we just move this back? Carry on, Lou.
So can I just get it straight? Jesus spoke Aramaic but knew the Hebrew from being in the synagogue?
Yeah, we don't know very much about the languages that were being spoken, but we know that the scholars did record things in Hebrew and gets the law papers, which were to be read more widely than just by scholars, were in Aramaic. So we assume that sort of situation occurred.
But when he went to the synagogue and looked at the scroll,
did it work? Well, when you read out a Bible scroll, of course, it's got to be in Hebrew. But what they would do is, immediately after the Hebrew reading from the Old Testament, you would have someone stand up and translate it into Aramaic. Now, they didn't have a written Targum, they didn't have a written translation into Aramaic, but it was a fairly conservative sort of process. You'd have someone who was trained as a Targum and who would then stand and give this recital in Aramaic, because the people sitting in the pews didn't actually understand it. It's a bit like reading Chaucer and expecting to understand it.